Brigadier Daniel Reel 7. I'd like to pick up the story now from where we left off on the journey up to Tobruk. You'd got to Mina. There was supposed to be a very wild party at Mina amongst the officers and men. Were you aware of that at the time?
No, I was not aware of it in the least because I was staying in my own flat in Cairo. And I rejoined them at 6 o'clock in the morning when I told them to be ready to set off. We set off and I insisted on the vehicles being at a distance of 30 yards between each vehicle, and there were no stops and no vehicle was allowed to drive off the road. I put the colonel, he was in charge of them, he would lead them, and I brought up the rear and I said I would shoot any driver whom I found had driven his vehicle off the road for any reason other than a mechanical breakdown.
Now why 30 yards?
Because I didn't know what attack we might encounter.
Now there was a briefing by Dibbs, Brigadier Dibb, while at Mina. Do you remember that at all?
No.
Not right. Now as you went forward, could you take up what was the situation as you were moving forward?
Well, towards the evening, we had reached halfway to Murder Mishu. I did my very utmost to tell and explain to every single man in the regiment that they would get. And we would halt at 5 o'clock and they would have the tea. And if they said about talking and smoking and did not have that tea, that at 6 o'clock it would be so dark that they wouldn't be able to see their own hands and they would find themselves lost. Certainly 30% of the regiment sat about and talked and smoked, did not have their meal, and at 6:30 were calling, shouting to their friends that they were completely lost. And they went on making this noise all night long till I got fed up and had them shut up and told them to go to sleep wherever they were. Lie down on the desert and go to sleep. They'd never find that truck again. It was their fault, they missed it. We went on to Mirza Matru, where I stopped so that every soldier could, an officer, could have a bathe and have a meal and fill up with petrol. We went up the escarpment. We set off for Matru after dark from Matru. And halfway between Matru and Tobruk, there was a signal post. I stopped and I told the signalers to get themselves packed up. They were not required any further as a telephonic link because the Germans would be there within 2 or 3 hours of our passing. A very astute sergeant did exactly what I told him to do, and they arrived safely, all of them and all their equipment, before the Germans reached them.
So you realised the Germans had swept round to Broca?
There was that night that we set off from Mirza Matru, and I could see it quite plainly, a very heavy heavy air attack on Tobruk. And that attack continued every single night until we got there. So it's quite easy to see they'd go around into Tobruk. And against all instructions, when we reached halfway to Durot, I ordered the column of 600 lorries waiting for my protection.
That was at Saloum you picked them up, wasn't it?
Yes, at Saloum. That every color, all the vehicles should be divided into three columns. One was on the main road and one was on each side. I put a gun at the top of each column, and I ordered the first 20 vehicles to turn their headlights full on. The Germans had never seen anything like this before, and we could see them running away in front of us. They were round on the road, but they'd never seen this terrific glare coming on, and they frightened it, and they ran off into the hills. And every now and then, I told one of the guns to stop and put a couple of rounds into the hills to hasten the retreat of any Germans who were trying to ambush the column on the road.
So you think without that action, you wouldn't have even got into Tobruk?
No.
Now, what was Seeley doing? You say you did this, but you were only second in command. What was Seeley doing? What was the chain of command? Or would you advise Seeley? Or what?
How did I was Seeley's advisor, and I drove ahead of Seeley with the guns on either side of me.
So when you say you gave orders, you were giving them through the normal system, but they originated with you,
yes.
And you'd advise Seeley, and then Seeley would give the order. Is that what you mean?
It is what I mean. It's what I did.
And as you got nearer, what happened then?
It got later and later, and the air attack was very heavy that night. And as we got nearer to Dunbrook, the glare of the headlights of the lorries disturbed the air night attack by the Italians. They couldn't understand it. They'd never seen it happen before in the desert, because there were strict rules in the desert that no vehicle ever put their headlights on after dark. And the effect of this terrific days of light, in the end, they turned around and they went home. So that we could occupy Tobruk with the greatest of ease and no attack from the air at all. But I found there was a continual stream of traffic coming down the main road through Tobruk, mostly Australians in lorries. And so I drew a couple of guns across the road and stopped all traffic going to Cairo, because if I was going to stay in Tobruk and be surrounded in Tobruk, I thought it preferable to be surrounded with as many other people as possible.
Now, the initial positions they took up were a place called Eagle Crossroads, where that's just the first night, midnight... the 9th of April you got in. Now, was the situation fairly chaotic that night?
Dead quiet. All the Italian aircraft had gone. And I was quite unable to allot any positions with the help of the colonel of the South Docks and so on, any gun position, as I had no map to go, and it was pitch dark. So I said we will wait till dawn, and then you and I will pick up the gun positions and allot them to the battery commanders as soon as we can. And as for the column of lorries, they had disappeared.
The column that had come with you, the That was a supply column, was it? Or what was?
They don't ask me. I never asked them.
Now, what happened next morning then?
Next morning, we occupied the positions we chose, and the battery commanders had that men dig in where they could, where the ground was sufficiently soft for them to dig trenches for themselves and to dig a slight gun position, so the guns were slightly out of sight and camouflage nets could be put over them.
Now the first positions were near Fort Palestrina, or by the El Adem Road, either side or the other. Now, where would you set up your position? I mean, the guns were put out. Where would you be? What? Where was your?
I made the Colonel Sheely's headquarters just below the escarpment.
Which escarpment?
That went through to Brook. In the centre of the escarpment, there was a small tin hut immediately above us, and that had been taken over by the Moss Artillery Battery as their headquarters.
That was the first RHA.
First RHA.
And you were split out, alternative troops, weren't you?
Yes.
With them.
Yes.
Could you explain the reason? Were you involved in that decision, or do you know why they did that?
No. They ran their own show, and they ran it very well. I knew them all personally very well. And I myself made a sandbagged slit trench on the top of the escarpment so that I could always know what was happening by seeing what was happening on the frontier.
On the perimeter?
On the perimeter.
You could see the perimeter from there, could you? What was your dugout look like? I mean, was it just a slit trench, a hole in the ground, or?
Well, there was a picture of me there sitting on it, if you want to see it.
Right, I've seen it. They can look at that, because there's a picture of it in the War Museum. So, what kit would you keep there?
I had a spare pair of boots, shaving kit, and I mistrusted the Australian element in Tobruk.
Why was that?
Because I did.
Do you mean you mistrusted them militarily, or you mistrusted
them? Militarily.
You thought they might run away, or what?
No, I thought they might not do what they were told to do. And they never did. They never arrived at an arranged hour for a night attack. They usually never arrived at all, or if they did arrive, they arrived several hours later, which was very difficult for me, who was arranging the barrage from all the guns.
Now, that's taken us on a little later. Now, one thing, that when you got into Tobruk, there were some tank battles very early on, the first 4 or 5 days, or a series of 2 or 3 major attacks by the Germans. It was Good Friday, the Saturday, and the Monday, I think.
Well,
what do you remember of those attacks, and what was your role during them?
My role was to try and concentrate the fire of all the guns I possibly could. You must remember that there were several other batteries that were not under my command.
There were 1st RHA and 106 RHA.
Yes. And at a future time there were the Westmoreland Cumberland Yeomanry. And to try and concentrate all the fire on the gap in the wire that the Germans had cut and through which the tanks were coming. The effect of that was that when they tried to bring their infantry through, the infantry were wiped out. And the lorries were blown up and set on fire, and the men who were sitting on the tanks removed themselves from the German tanks and followed in behind them on their feet.
So your intention was the tanks would come through and then you'd almost close the gap with artillery, so nothing else?
Yes, at all costs, to keep out as much as we could at every single infantryman we could.
So the key thing was to separate the tanks from their supporting infantry.
Yeah.
And then you deal with the tanks later, I presume. But
yes.
The idea was to... So, right. Now, how would you achieve such a concentration of fire? I mean, technically. Do you remember now?
I had a telephone to the Cannon Council headquarters. And I told him exactly what... which I moved up. So we were to the top of the escarpment, so I could see what was happening. I told him what I thought we ought to do, and he agreed, and said, go ahead and do it. And I did. And the battery commanders did not like it.
Why not? What did they think should be done?
I didn't ask them. But they obviously thought that they were perfectly capable of controlling their own batteries where they thought it was necessary to bring the fire down.
So what they objected to was you taking control of their batteries from them and telling them to fire at a certain place?
They objected to anything that I, as second in command, insisted should be done and done at once.
Now, did you actually see the tanks yourself?
Certainly I saw them. One came right up within a few 40 yards of where my... little sandbag dwelling place was.
So it got right through into the middle of the perimeter, into the middle of the defended area?
Right through. And the thing fell off.
Track?
The track fell off for some unknown reason. Now this is very important. Track fell off 40 yards from where I was. I saw the young men jump out of the tank and run into a hole and lie down. So I walked over there and told these young men that they should go down towards the sea, where they would find several British posts, and they should surrender themselves at any post they liked. I needed to go and look at that tank. They were all terrified. They didn't, not one of them tried to stop me. And I went and looked at that tank.
What
was a brand new tank. It had come up to Brook on a tank trailer.
What type was it? Would you recognize?
Mark IV. Yeah, I'd never seen one before. And it had a short 75 gun. Up to that time, the tanks that they'd been using were Panther tanks with long guns, long 75s.
Would that be the Mark III?
Yes. That's right. These are the Mark IV. I took a photograph of them very carefully, and I sent the photograph back to Cairo by some means or other. I think probably by one of the destroyers when it came up in the dark night to the chief artillery officer at the headquarters at Cairo, pointing out to him that these were brand new tanks and that they had short 75 guns, with the result that their range was 1.25 miles further than the Mark III tanks. Unfortunately, he took no notice of either the photograph, which was as sheets in that book, very good photographs of the tank, or of what I said, with the result that when the first effort to a complete and absolute failure, as the German tanks had a far further reaching shell than our tanks had.
That was in June, mid-June. Yeah. Now, this tank, what had it been hit? That's why the track came off eventually, or did the track just come off on its own?
I didn't know, and I'll tell you why I didn't know. Having been down as a tank, and I took nothing out of it, there was nothing that I wanted to take out, and it absolutely smoked second legs that had come from the leeway. You know, all of the nice smell of leather everywhere. And I don't think it had fired a shot. And no sooner had I gone to talk to the Colonel Seeley and to tell him that the attack had failed and ceased, than the Padre came up behind me and set fire to the tank.
Padre Parry?
Yes.
And why did he do that?
Because he had an inherent dislike of German tanks.
But surely it wasn't a sensible thing to do. It would have been a useful example.
But of course. You can't argue with the Reverend Parry. See, we should do a thing, he does it.
And so the tank was burnt out?
Burnt out.
So you couldn't see what had happened?
Nothing at all. Or I'm still nothing about to get a photograph of it.
What do you remember of the rest of those opening attacks? So there's sort of three in about 4 days.
I don't remember anything except that they were, as a whole, were ineffectual, as their casualties were heavier than their gains.
The German attack.
Yes.
There was one point when one of the OPs actually asked for fire to be brought down on the OP in the front line. Do you remember that occasion?
Yeah.
No. The other thing that from your memoirs that I note is that you went forward to look at the anti-tank ditch where. Yeah. Could you tell me that story, what exactly happened?
After the successful German breakthrough of the frontier of the Tobruk position, and the attack had ceased, and the tanks had suffered heavy losses, and the infantry very heavy losses. In the evening, the Reverend Parry and myself and my doctor, we walked...
Would that be Finnegan?
Finnegan, yeah. Irishman. We walked, we took a couple of men with us, carrying water, and we walked up to the gap in the wild where the tanks had come through. We found that the anti-tank ditch, which was about 9 foot deep, was absolutely crammed. It's all in there with German wounded who had crawled in there from the vehicles that they'd been traveling in that our shells had set on fire. And none of them had, to any extent, come in to the perimeter, and they were lying in the trenches in the anti-tank ditch, which was not a big obstacle. We started giving them water, and while the doctor was attending one of the soldiers who was badly wounded, I saw myself a German rise up on a seat and have a shot at him with a revolver. So I shouted to the doctor to withdraw and to Reverend Parry to withdraw, and I left the water for the wounded, and I said to them, "Look, speak English. If you shoot at my efforts to try and alleviate you your wounded, then you can fend for yourselves and I will take no more action." And I turned around and walked.
Now, just one point. The tanks that had broken through, you'd cut off... this is going back again.
Yes.
You'd cut off their support,
yes.
But there were still several tanks
several
within
tanks.
The perimeter.
Yes.
How were they dealt with? Who dealt with them? I mean, was it the artillery, or would the British tanks deal with it, or what?
No, there were no British tanks.
So what happened? How were they dealt with?
As far as I can remember, they dealt with themselves. They stayed there as long as they thought they were required, and then they really withdrew.
So they couldn't achieve much on their own without supporting infantry?
No, they couldn't.
So they were just roaming round?
They were roaming round, like they wandered round up to me.
And then went back?
Yeah, and they left. They left a few tanks, and then a certain number of infantry came through and dug slip trenches and stayed in them. In one third of the area, they took over one third of the area.
Right, so now, after that, the siege began, you know, the siege proper. What was your routine during the siege? What would a typical day be like for you?
First thing in the morning when I had breakfast, I drove out to the minefield, which was inside the wire. I left my truck there and my driver. I walked across the minefield and visited the nearest FRO in his position to get the latest news from him, because he could see what had happened during the night, which I far away couldn't. I then went back to the regimental headquarters and dealt with anything that affected me.
And what sort of things would that be? What was your role?
Really nothing affected me, except anybody who battery commander wished to change his position, or the position of his FOOs on the borders of the perimeter.
They'd consult with you?
They had to receive permission to do so. They didn't consult at all. They asked for permission to do it, and it was granted or not, according to what Colonel Seely wished. Colonel Seely was in complete command of his own regiment. I was his advisor, and that is all.
Now, what else would you do during the day?
Well, I would probably go down and to the Tobruk fort and see if there were any ships had come in during the night from outside into the harbour, because during the three dark nights of the month, the two destroyers came up. Australian destroyers. They were eventually all sunk by mines. But when they did come up, they brought up supplies and they took back the wounded.
Now, your wife,
yes.
Betty,
yes.
She was staying in Alexandria, was it, or Cairo?
She was in Alexandria, some of the time, yes.
And she arranged to get some supplies sent
yes.
into you. Can you tell me how she did that?
How she did it? By being polite to the officers of the destroyers who were going to go up that night.
And what would she send forward for you?
A bottle of whiskey, cigarettes, cigar or two, sweets, chocolate, anything she thought I'd like. Sometimes she said some clothing, which was quite unnecessary. I clean this.